From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Wayne County's money miseries are piling up. Our leaders meeting the challenge.
Everybody wants to put their stamp on things, and I think moving slowly is not their friend here.
Looking at the gender wage gap in Michigan.
The prosperity or lack thereof of a female worker has great implications for our society and for our children.
How to reduce Michigan's prison population and corrections costs.
We're paying for people who are developmentally disabled, who are suffering from dementia, who have terminal illnesses. We have to stop and think who we're locking up and why.
And how did it feel to live in Nazi Germany as a Jewish wife and mother?
In writing her story, I came to understand my own relationship to my family's history in Germany and to the Holocaust.
As Wayne County slides into a financial abyss, who's in control? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, are Wayne County's leaders doing what's needed to meet the financial crisis? But first, there's no denying state spending and budgets are stretched tight, and that's forcing a fresh look at the soaring costs of corrections. What are we really getting for the $2 billion a year we spend on corrections, and how can we trim that prison bill? A nonpartisan nonprofit group called the Citizens Alliance for Prisons and Public Spending offers strategies to cut the prison population by 10,000 inmates without, they say, impacting public safety. Barbara Levine is with CAPS. Barbara, you've prepared a strategy to cut Michigan's prison population by 10,000. What would that save us?
$250 million, $250 million a year once these strategies took full effect, and we estimate 5 years.
Well, before we get into the strategies, let's look a little about what has caused the population and our expenses to balloon. When did this all kind of begin? Because when we think about 1973, we had fewer than 7,900 inmates in Michigan's prisons. What do we have, over 43,000 now?
Right, and it actually was as high as 51,500. It peaked in 2006 and has actually come down significantly since then. Unfortunately, the costs don't come down, but the population size has some, and we think we could safely do it at least another 10,000. What's caused it is the sort of what people call the get-tough strategies of policies of particularly the very late 70s, the 80s, and into the 90s, when the attitude was to keep people locked up for as long as possible. And sentences got longer, parole policies got tougher. In 1998, the state adopted Michigan's version of truth in sentencing that eliminated any amount of good time credit for prisoner good conduct or program participation. So there were lots of different steps taken that all added up to make Michigan's average prisoner length of stay, the amount of time prisoners serve in the state, substantially longer than the national average.
So we're keeping them in a lot longer. When we think corrections used to take up about 1.6% of general fund spending, and today it's nearly 20%. And we've all heard loudly and often by advocates of education that we spend $2 billion a year on corrections and we spend about $1.4 billion on higher education.
Yep. You can look at a line graph and see when the lines crossed. It used to be the opposite. It used to be we spent more on higher ed, and then it shifted and started in the other direction.
I'm speaking with Barbara Levine of Citizens Alliance for Prisons and Public Spending. They're offering strategies for reining in our corrections spending by shrinking Michigan's prison population. So let's talk about the areas where you've grouped your recommendations. Certainly, you know, you've got to reduce the number of people going in. That's a place to start. How would you suggest doing that?
You can adjust. Our sentencing guidelines were implemented in 1998, and then the commission that developed them and was supposed to oversee them and monitor their effectiveness was first defunded and then eliminated. And now the governor has just established a new Criminal Justice Policy Commission to look at our sentencing guidelines and also to look at parole and everything that actually impacts length of stay. For the sake of full disclosure, I'm one of the appointees to that commission, which has just begun its work. But one of the things that can be looked at is adjusting the sentencing guidelines to keep more people in community-based programs rather than going into prisons. You can have more intensive supervision of high-risk probationers than we currently have.
And I would suspect that's cheaper than keeping them in prison.
Oh, absolutely. Drug courts have been very successful. We can increase the use of drug courts, sobriety courts, mental health courts, veterans courts, things that address the causes of people's behavior, more participation and more availability of substance abuse and mental health treatment. As I'm sure you're aware, corrections and county jails have become the biggest provider of mental health services in this state, because when they expanded the prisons and shut down state mental health hospitals, the money didn't follow the mentally ill into the community. So now what you have is people who are mentally ill getting into trouble in the community and ending up in prison. 20% of the prison population is mentally ill, and I think the figures are even higher at the local jail. Things like changing the age of criminal responsibility so that 17-year-olds aren't being sent to prison. Michigan is one of only 9 states where the age of criminal responsibility is under 18. It's things that affect intake. And then for those people who do go to prison, it's things that affect the length of stay. Again, adjustments to sentencing guidelines can reduce the length of some sentences. We can adjust the way we treat habitual offenders. Right now, people's prior record can be counted in multiple ways, so their sentences just get longer and then longer again and then longer again. Mm. And then at the back end, there are various steps that could be taken to increase the rate of paroles for people who have served their minimum sentences.
You talk about in your report establishing presumptive parole. What is that?
Presumptive parole is a concept that we've been advocating for a long time, and I'm very happy to say there's actually a bill that got out of the House Criminal Justice Committee that would enact a presumption that when somebody who scores high probability of release on the Department of Corrections' own parole guidelines, that is, they fall into a low risk of reoffending category, that those people would actually get paroled when they've served their minimum sentence. We're not talking about an early release, but they would get paroled when they serve their minimum unless some very specific exceptions were met. Right now, there's about 1,900 prisoners who score high probability on those parole guidelines who have been denied release. And in hundreds of cases, the reasons given are very subjective. They're like insufficient remorse, lacks adequate insight. But what you can see when you start digging into statistics is that by far the largest number of those people committed a homicide offense, another sort of assault of offense, or a sex offense, and the board is reacting to the crime. Well, the crime was already taken into account in the length of sentence in the first place, and it really isn't the board's role to resentence people because they don't think the sentence was long enough. So unless there's evidence that somebody is currently a risk to public safety, and people who committed serious offenses years or even decades ago are not necessarily a risk today. In fact, they're likely not a risk today. And people who committed homicide and sex offenses actually have the lowest risk of reoffending of any of the offense groups. So the goal is to establish a presumption in statute that would make clear the expectation that people who have served their minimum and they've done their time well, they don't have a history of serious institutional misconduct, they don't have any charges pending, there's no evidence that they would be a risk to somebody today, those people should get out when they've done their time.
Now, you referenced, Barbara Levine, the State House having the Criminal Justice Committee having passed out the parole reform bill that would make it easier for some inmates to get out of prison. And we know that a similar bill got some real pushback a year ago from law enforcement groups and State Attorney General Schuette saying they could threaten public safety. How can you promise these suggested reforms could be done without risking public safety?
Because you look at the data. You look at the actual evidence. You see that the reoffense rates, as I said, for homicide and sex offenders are the lowest of any offense group. You look at the fact that you're keeping people far longer than in other states, and there's no evidence that Michigan is safer than other places. There's no evidence, and there's been a lot of academic research on it. There's simply no evidence that there's a relationship between how long you keep people and their likelihood of reoffending. We've got people walking the prison halls using walkers, being pushed in wheelchairs. What we're finding out is that this whole attitude in the 80s and the 90s that you couldn't sentence people harshly enough is resulting in taxpayers paying for people in their 60s, their 70s, their 80s, long, long past the time when they present any risk or could present a risk if they wanted to. We're paying for people who are developmentally disabled, who are suffering from dementia, who have terminal illnesses. We have to stop and think. who we're locking up and why, and look at their actual risk as opposed to the rhetoric. The other thing is, it's people who are opposed to presumptive parole or to the felony firearms, the change in the felony firearm statute that also came out of committee, which goes to how long we keep people. Opponents to criminal justice reform generally talk about what this will do to victims. It won't do anything to victims. It's a false dichotomy to set victims as an interest against criminal justice reform. Nothing in any of our proposals would prevent a judge from giving a long sentence to somebody who has committed a serious crime. Nothing would require the parole board to release somebody where there's evidence that they're currently a risk. Nothing would affect the rights of victims to present their concerns at sentencing or during the parole process. Nobody has a lock on being concerned about victims. You know, Governor Snyder in his message was very strong on improving services to victims. But at the same time, he endorsed presumptive parole because you can't just keep saying no. You have to look at what the evidence says and what the costs and benefits are of what you're doing.
You've got the governor calling for smart justice and reforming
yes.
criminal justice. So this report of yours comes at a time when it seems the governor is on the same wavelength. And I'm just wondering, how do you hope that your research and this report from the Citizens Alliance on Prison and Public Spending will help Michigan shift thought processes and correction strategies that seemed appropriate 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, we do things like, you know, talk through the media, which is enormously helpful. We do as much public outreach and public education as we can. We certainly share all our work with legislators and testify whenever bills are up. We work in legislative work groups, as we did, for instance, on the presumptive parole bill, and support other bills. It was Rep. Heisey, the chair of the committee, who actually initiated the felony firearm bill himself. Some of the reforms would save a few hundred beds, some would save a few thousand, but collectively they would add up, we believe, to 10,000 without any of them individually jeopardizing public safety.
Barbara Levine is with the Citizens Alliance on Prisons and Public Spending. You can find the report on their website. It's caps-mi.org. That's caps-mi.org. Barbara, thank you so much for speaking with
Cynthia.
Us.
Thank you, I appreciated the opportunity to talk with you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Anyone with even a passing knowledge of world history knows that unspeakable horrors came out of the Nazi attempt to exterminate the Jews of Europe. Some 6 million of Europe's Jewish men, women, and children killed in the Holocaust. Millions more displaced from their homes. My next guest brings us this huge, huge story in an intimate way that takes the reader right into the heart of the Holocaust and through it to triumph over Hitler and the Nazis. Barbara Stark-Nieman's debut novel is Even in Darkness, the true story of Barbara's great-aunt, Clara Kohler. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here.
Well, your great-aunt Clara was the only one of her siblings to not get out of Germany ahead of the Nazis' total takeover. So that's in your family. How did you come to the idea that you were going to turn this story into a novel?
I grew up with stories of the Holocaust that were really different from the other kids and the other families in the Jewish community that I grew up in that my family did not hate all Germans. I had an aunt who lived in Germany who survived the Holocaust and didn't leave when she was liberated. I met her when I was 4. And I fell in love with her immediately. She was a charming and wonderful and gracious person. But her life was a mystery. I couldn't figure out why didn't she leave when the rest of us were in the United States and in Belgium and in England. And I didn't understand it. We visited her. As soon as I started traveling to Europe, we never went without stopping one side or the other of wherever else we were going to visit her. So I came to know her, and I came to know the priest that she created this life with.
And this is the thing. We'll give everybody a sense. So she lives through the Holocaust. We're going to talk about the details. She is deported to Theresienstadt, which was a labor camp, concentration camp. But then after the war,
she didn't leave. She stayed and went to live secretly as a Jew with a Catholic priest for the remaining 40 years of her life.
She made a home and she was his housekeeper.
She was his housekeeper. There is that role in mm-hmm. Germany of a respectable woman caring for and taking care of a Catholic priest.
And that's not unknown here in the States or other countries. Absolutely. Yes.
Exactly. And she was a brilliant woman. She was witty. They both were. And in writing her story, I came to understand my own relationship to my family's history in Germany and to the Holocaust. And I was inspired by her, and it was that inspiration both of from my aunt and from the priest that caused me to write this book.
And his name is Ansel.
Yes.
All right. You begin your story in 1913, and Clara is a teenager. And even in those very early pages, we get the sense that even before the First World War, anti-Semitism was creeping into everyday life in Germany?
Yes. It did. It was part of life, and it was an accepted part of life. And it was – German Jews, like my family, were very assimilated. They were allowed to own property. They were allowed to hold professional jobs.
They fought in World War I for Germany?
They did. Yeah. Both my grandfathers were very proud of their military service. They were very devoted Germans and Jews. And this was a situation that was not uncommon. So it was interesting to me that alongside that patriotism and that assimilation, there was a chronic sense also that the anti-Semitism was there and it was a part of their everyday lives.
Well, we're right there. You take us right there with Clara as she marries. She has two sons and Germany becomes more and more dangerous for Jews like Clara and her husband. And I'm watching it as she gets her two sons out. She has one go to England and one go to Palestine. But why couldn't she get herself and her husband out? Even her siblings got out.
She would not leave her husband, who had been gassed in World War I and was ill. And if you were ill, you could not get a visa to leave the country. You couldn't be admitted to the United States. Mm-hmm. And her mother, who was elderly, did not feel like she could make that move. She could not leave with my grandfather, even though he begged her to do that. So she would not leave her mother, my great-grandmother, and she would not leave her husband.
So there they faced what was happening. And as we read your novel, you can really feel the noose tightening around Clara and the other Jews in her world, step by step, and then the bloodletting begins. I'm wondering if you read us an excerpt from your book, and this comes from May 1933, and Clara is on an errand in the city of Herde. I wonder if you'll read for us.
Sure. The morning housework finished, Clara had dressed and made her way into the town center. Now, as she approached the stationery shop, which she had not entered since the night of the emigration meeting, her thoughts returned to all she had heard and done in the weeks since. Ernst had written her back by return post. No, he did not think Palestine was the answer. Yes, he shared her concern at the worsening conditions, but did not feel the need to leave. He still believed that the rule of law would prevail and the country would right itself. Clara was not comforted. She had nearly reached the door to the small shop when it flew open and a man's body hurtled onto the street, followed swiftly by another. Clara immediately recognized the smaller man as the stationer himself. He was bent over on his knees and his coat was half torn from his body. As he raised his head, Clara saw blood oozing from his disheveled hair. No sooner had he started to stand when three brown-shirted stormtroopers burst from the shop, shouting. They began to savagely beat the two men with clubs, and as one tried to regain his feet, a trooper kicked his legs out from under him and continued the beating. The man fell heavily toward Clara, who had backed into the doorway of the shop next door. Clara looked wildly from the body, which now blocked the sidewalk in front of her, to the troopers still shouting in staccato bursts, "Communist! Filthy Jew! We show you what good Germans will do!" Clara felt the blood rush from her head. She stared at the man at her feet, his one eye bloodied and shut, his other eye wide with panic. A trooper shouted at her, "Don't touch him!" Clara hardly knew that she had bent toward the beaten man. "He is a filthy Jew communist," the trooper said, and eyeing her honey blonde hair and smart dress, "You are a good German. Leave him."
That is Ann Arbor writer Barbara Stark Nieman reading from her debut novel, Even in Darkness. It's the true story of her great aunt Clara Kohler and her triumph over Nazism. Why a novel to tell her story and not a biography?
I struggled with that, Cynthia. I thought at first I'd write a biography or a memoir. Mm-hmm. And I knew her well. I'd interviewed her. I'd interviewed the priest. I had this just boxes full of documents and letters that I'd translated and research that I'd done. But there were certain things I could not know and would not ask her out of respect for her and what she'd gone through. And I'm a reader and a fiction writer, and I love a novel's ability to transport us immediately. None of this, one can only imagine that. I wanted the reader to be in the story, and for those reasons, I decided to write it as a novel. Plus, it was the number one item on my bucket list.
Was to write a novel. You did a beautiful one. You have us right there inside of it, and so we're watching the curtains opening on what becomes the Holocaust. And we do now understand, because of the way you describe Clara and her family, why people chose to say, no, it can't get any worse. It can't get any worse. And then it does. So Clara, her husband, and her mother are deported to Theresienstadt. How in the world did they all manage to survive and not be selected to go to Auschwitz or the other death camps? Because mother's elderly, the husband is ill. I couldn't believe that they got out from the other end intact, alive.
My family always had the concept that Clara was lucky. Mm. And I do think that luck had something to do with it. What I've learned is that her luck was her unerring capacity to see the glass half full, to find a way to make her life work in situations that certainly would have daunted me beyond the ability to act. And she had prepared herself when she learned that she had to stay in Germany. She'd prepared herself and became a massage therapist. And I'm fairly certain that her role as a massage therapist and the relationship that she developed with the commandant as a result of that,
Who had headaches.
Yes. Was part of what saved her. They were on the transport list more than once, and she managed to get them off. So it's a combination of luck and her capacity to figure out a way to make her life work that I think is the explanation. It's the only explanation that I can understand. The guy in the sky was looking out for all those people.
How hard was it as you did your research, and you spent, what, some 15 years researching, apart from the fact that a lifetime of talking to your great aunt, how hard was it especially to put yourself right there in the concentration camp in order to bring us, your readers, there?
Well, I had these letters. I had the letters that my great-grandmother wrote on a bread wrapper. That was the only paper she had, and in tiny, nearly indecipherable script, she wrote letters about her life there. And somehow Clara managed to save those letters. They were never sent. The letters were intended for my great-grandmother's children. Clara was with her, but she had three other children, including my grandfather and two daughters. And she wrote these letters as a testimony to her love for them and her desire for them to know that they were her life and that they were meant everything to her. But she also described where they lived. She described what happened to them. And I was able to translate those letters. And so I knew a lot.
But emotionally, what did that do for you to kind of get a sense of what it was like to be in the middle of that?
Well, I went there. Mm-hmm. I went to Theresienstadt three times. One time I went and toured it, and then I was I'd made arrangements to work in the archives, and I found all the information about all the different family members. I had a number of family members aside from Clara who were in Theresienstadt. So I found that information, and they have done a beautiful job of recreating rooms and streets. My mother's entire family went to Theresienstadt. My mother, my father, my sisters and brothers, all the grandchildren. And when we went there, there's a museum. And in the museum is an exhibit of art that was created by the people who were interned in Theresienstadt. Beautiful paintings, drawings. And on the wall, my brother and I approached a wall, and there was a picture of Clara with her kerchief, her star, and her ugly uniform that she wore. And this is when she was working in the laundry. And there's no question that it was her. And that was a stunning moment because there she was, right there on the wall, with all of what we'd seen. It just brought it alive. And then she spoke about it to me, not in great detail, but enough so that I got a living sense from her of the emotion and the trauma of those times.
And then after the war, she goes to be the housekeeper for her good friend's son. That's how they came to find each other in life, and really was a mom to him in a way that his own mom really wasn't, or stepmom.
Well, yeah. His mom died when he was four. And the woman that became his stepmother was a very close friend of Clara's. And she did her best.
Yes.
But she walked into a pre-war family with five children. He alone, Ansel alone, was sent off to an orphanage to live with an aunt of his who was a nun there. And he did meet Clara during his childhood. And then later, his stepmother sent him to find Clara and help her. This was before she was put into the concentration camp. And then again, his stepmother said, find her and help her when she was liberated and was in a displaced persons camp.
And he did. And it really is a beautiful illustration as she as you said, she's like a closet Jew. I mean, people in the parish didn't know, and she was that nice older lady that was his housekeeper. And she'd be sitting in the pews at church while he said Mass. And it does show how boundaries are very fluid, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They were part mother-son. Mm-hmm. She'd lost her children. He'd lost his mother. They were part intellectual sparring partners, but they were really soulmates. Mm-hmm. That is what was established early on in their relationship and stayed that way until the day she died at 100.
Is he still alive?
He is.
Father Ansel is still alive. Well, you spent more than three decades as a speech and language pathologist, and now you have this new role. You've checked it off the bucket list. You wrote a novel. It's a beautiful novel. How does it feel to be a writer, to say, I am a writer?
I love it. I'm enjoying it. I had a wonderful career, one that I felt I was good at and that I really understood what it was that I contributed. And it's a gift to be feeling that again.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful book, Barbara Stark Niemann's debut novel, Even in Darkness. Thank you so much for being with us and for sharing Clara's Holocaust survival story with us.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Wayne County slides into a financial abyss, who's in control? Pretty good question, considering the fiscal troubles were made much worse by its elected leaders. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. Daniel, start with the dollars and cents. How big is Wayne County's deficit?
It's about $75 million structural operating deficit, and it's likely to get worse before it gets better. You know, they've got two pension plans, one of which is only 44% funded and the other is 58% funded, both of which I think are below where Detroit's pension funds were in terms of funding when they went into bankruptcy.
Oof.
It's only likely to get worse. Their property tax revenue is running about $100 million below what it was in 2008 on an annual basis. and it's not rebounding in the ways it is in some other localities. I think that's in part because, you know, people are frankly leaving, and you know, Wayne County has lost some population and probably will continue to lose some population. It's not a well-run county. It's pretty obvious that it's not a well-run county, and that's made even more stark when you look at a place like Oakland County, which is one of the most well-run counties in the United States.
Are these storm clouds giving you a sense of deja vu?
In some senses, yes. I mean, I see the commission chair comes out last week when County Executive Warren Evans writes a letter asking the state treasury to declare a financial emergency. The commission chair comes out and says, hey, we're still in charge. We're the people under the law who would accept the declaration of an emergency and then lay out the steps going forward. And technically he's right, but I think the broader point here is that there's more focus on telling everybody who's in charge than actually acting. And I think that reminds me a lot of Detroit City Council when Dave Bing was mayor, and they had 11 months to work on and deliver their consent agreement with Treasury, and they basically did almost nothing. And I think that is what certainly ensured the appointment of Kevin Orr as emergency manager and ultimately a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing.
Well, where do you see Wayne County's situation differing from Detroit's situation, particularly pre-bankruptcy, pre-Kevin Orr?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that Public Act 436 that allowed for Orr's appointment and then the Chapter 9 filing for the city doesn't as neatly apply to counties in the state of Michigan. Now, that law could be amended if you needed to in a situation like this, but that would be a very politically fraught kind of move. The other thing is that in a county you have, I think it's five different elected officials, a sheriff, a prosecutor, a couple of others, and they don't have to necessarily answer to one another, and they have their own constituencies. In the city of Detroit, for example, you have a mayor. He's the chief executive. It's a much cleaner process that can go into Chapter 9 than you could in a county. And I know for a fact that people in Lansing have looked at this, and Kevin Orr himself has acknowledged to me on several occasions that he spent some time looking at it and looking at the applicability of Chapter 9 bankruptcy to the county, and came to the conclusion that it's not impossible, but it's far more complicated.
You're very clear in your column today for the Detroit News, Daniel. You are laying much of the blame squarely on the head of former Wayne County Executive Robert Ficano.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is look at the pension fund as an example. When he came into office, it was fully funded. It was doing very well. And by the time he leaves office, it's dramatically underfunded, pushing $1 billion in terms of those are obligations to retirees that they will be obligated to honor in some way, shape, or form. Now, if you go into a bankruptcy proceeding, you could cut some kind of, you know, pennies on the dollar kind of deal, a la what they did in the city of Detroit. But at the end of the day, the politicians have cut deals and offered early retirements and sweetened programs and everything else that put taxpayers on the hook. And they're going to try to get some of this money from taxpayers, and I think taxpayers are going to say, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore. They've been abused for a very long time in Wayne County, and now Warren Evans, to his credit, not only does he have to pick up the pieces, he's moving with real dispatch to try and do that, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. I know that in Lansing, and particularly in the governor's office, they think very highly of Warren Evans and of his team and the people that are trying to execute this. And this is another example of where partisanship is very much in the background here. In fact, it's really not an issue. They're far more interested in a Republican administration and helping a Democratic administration in Wayne County fix the problem, and not necessarily point blame, but just fix the problem and move on.
Well, to kind of get an answer to the question you pose in your column, who is in control or who should be in control?
Well, I think, you know, the elected leaders should be and do play a role in all of this. But at the end of the day, the people that are putting together restructuring and are really trying to look at ways to do this is led by the county executive. It's not unlike a situation like you would have, say, in the city of Detroit, where you have a popularly elected mayor and a popularly elected council. But I think there is a tendency to focus a lot on the rights of the office and who's legally in charge, and everybody wants to put their stamp on things. And I think moving slowly is not their friend here. there needs to be some decisiveness and less concern about the political ramifications of what might happen. It's also important to note here, and this is a fact, and it will be viewed as a partisan comment, but it is a fact, is that the County Commission in Wayne County has been, for many, many years, is skewed Democratic. It's largely Democratic today. I think there's only two Republicans out of close to a dozen, if not more, commissioners. It's also no secret that there is a linkage between the public sector unions and the local Democratic Party. And I think there's a real concern that if certain kinds of actions are taken that are viewed deleterious to the unions, that there may be a political price to pay by some commissioners. Well, that's maybe true, but at the end of the day, the commissioners don't work for the unions. They work for the people of Wayne County, and those are some decisions they're going to have to make.
And if they don't make them with, as you say, with kind of efficiency and speed, what do you see playing out?
Well, I think we are definitely headed for a consent agreement in Wayne County where the county agrees with the state on a restructuring plan that it's going to have to execute. And I do think that the experience in Detroit is probably going to be somewhat informative, and I would suspect they're going to be a lot more proactive once that consent agreement is agreed upon. And there's a big difference between the administration of Warren Evans and the administration of Mayor Dave Bing. Dave Bing made a lot of noise about the financial problems of the city, but at the end of the day, he had trouble moving forward. He was not good at building coalitions on city council, so he didn't have a majority who kind of helped him move the ball forward, so to speak. I think Warren Evans is spending a lot more time. Number one, he's actually doing things as he moves forward. And number two, I think he recognizes that he can be more successful and the county can be more successful if he tries to be collaborative with the commission, with unions, and other key stakeholders. He certainly talks in that language, but I think he actually believes it because I think he's seen the price that can be paid if people are constantly battling with each other over turf instead of focusing on the problem and trying to move forward.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes keeping an eye on the Wayne County fiscal mess. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
The wage gap between men and women in Michigan needs to be looked at. This is a state where the 2010 U.S. Census found 284,000 families are headed by a female parent, and 28% of those households are living in poverty. That's something like 80,000 Michigan families. Bridge Magazine writer Ted Rolos looks at the wage gap in his latest story for Bridge Magazine. Welcome back to the program, Ted.
Good to be with you.
Let's start by looking at what the numbers tell us about the gender wage gap. First, what's the U.S. average?
78 cents on the dollar. That's women's wages compared to men, women who work full-time, men who work full-time.
All right. And in Michigan?
It's 75 cents on the dollar. So that puts Michigan, I think it's about 41st out of 50.
And I'm curious where the numbers come from and also the basis of comparison, just so we can really understand what it is we're talking about when we say in Michigan a woman is making 75 cents for every dollar a man makes.
We're looking at men and women who work at least 30 hours a week in the previous 12 months. It's not comparing how much you're making on a specific job. It's what you're earning. It doesn't take into account how many hours you're working. So it's a very broad measure, but it's an indication that, in the broadest terms, women who work full-time do not, on average, make as much as men who work full-time.
I know you're aware that there were readers commenting on your story in Bridge who really took issue with the statistics, saying unless you're comparing equal positions with equal experience, this data is worthless and flawed. In fact, you even note that a Washington Post fact-checking column called out President Obama for citing similar numbers in his State of the Union speech. So,
yeah, there's confusion about this issue, and I made it very clear in the piece that we did that we're not asserting that women are paid 75 cents on the dollar for doing the same work as men. That's not the point of this. It's just to take a broad look at what are the overall earnings for men and women, how do they compare, what are the reasons for that, ought there to be any remedies for that? And it's an open question.
Indeed. Are we seeing these disparities across the board? Are we seeing them in small companies as well as in big businesses like, you know, auto or pharmaceutical, the big companies?
One of the points we made in this article is to look at the types of occupations that men and women have. If you want to look at the lower end of the pay scale, you find a preponderance of women doing jobs like child care work, maids, home health care aides. There are somewhere in the range of 90% of those occupations. Those are basically poverty wages, even if you're working full-time. So that's part of the explanation on the lower end of the pay scale. And if you look at a lot of the professions, the higher-paying professions, you'll find that men tend to dominate a lot of the higher-paying professions. So it's an issue of what are the choices women are making on that end of it, is what kind of careers are they choosing? Are they motivated by salary, money? Are they perhaps motivated in other cases by wanting to choose a profession that's so-called nurturing or caring? So you find a higher percentage of women in professions like social work, nursing, teaching, that sort of thing. So that gets you pretty far down the road as to understanding why there is a difference in how much men earn and how much women earn.
And then we've got to fold in the biological realities of family demands or taking time out to bear and raise children, don't we?
It's easy for men to brush that aside, but I think there's been some changes in the way men and women look at their responsibilities as parents over the last 50 years. Clearly, men are taking more responsibility than they might have been in the old Leave It to Beaver days model of what a family is. But I looked at a survey of the Pew Research Center, and this was done in 2015. It said 39% of working mothers said they had taken significant time off from work to care for a child or family member, compared to 24% of working fathers. It also found that 50% of women said being a working parent made it harder to advance in their job, compared to 16% of men. And there's other evidence that if you look at this pay gap, research indicates that it's narrower when women are younger, but it tends to widen over time, which suggests that somewhere along the line, women are making sacrifices for their family that men aren't making, which tends to impact their long-term career earnings.
I'm talking with Bridge magazine writer Ted Roloffs. His piece in the June 9th edition of Bridge is, "In Paychecks, Michigan Women Have a Long Way to Go, Baby." And what are we seeing in terms of the toll being taken by this pay gap in Michigan, Ted?
People can draw their own conclusions, but if you look at the number of female single-parent households with children in Michigan and look at the wages they're earning on the lower end of the scale, whatever you think of this, whether you think this is no fault whatsoever of society, there are no arbitrary legislative solutions for this, if you're looking at a household where you've got a preponderance of the single-parent households in Michigan being headed by women and their wages being lower, clearly that has an impact on the children in those households.
Yes, you talked about the toxic stress that you see with this constantly stressed mom or caregiver.
Imagine you're trying to support a family, let's say a family of three, and you're a child care worker and you're bringing home roughly $20,000 a year. That's not an easy prescription for a family. Again, if you're looking at a single-parent household headed by a woman, and she's dealing with illness of a family member, what kind of flexibility does she have to take off of work? Can she even take off of work to care for a child, or would she be allowed to do that and be paid for that? And those are all questions that have profound implications on the kind of the cohesion of a family unit.
And certainly that can spill over into the academic achievement of the children.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it becomes a cycle when there's greater stress within the family. Oftentimes, a parent might be dealing with so much stress in his or her life that they don't have enough reserve to really deal with the needs of their children. And ultimately, that's going to have an impact on how well the kids are going to do in school and beyond that.
Sure, because you can just see that perpetuating another cycle of the next generation, settling for these low-paying and minimum-wage jobs and having the same stresses. What are some of the proposed strategies that you've heard as you explored everything for this story?
Well, there's a bill in Michigan in the state Senate that would allow workers to accumulate paid sick leave and give them the right to take paid days off to deal with family emergencies or family illnesses. That's a Democratic measure, and it's not expected to go anywhere, given the reaction of Republicans. And there's a couple federal measures that have been stalled, introduced in recent years, and they don't seem to be going anywhere either. And, you know, it's the same, similar politics that you're going to have on the state level. It's a lot of pushback saying these kinds of measures to give workers tools to combat wage discrimination, that sort of thing, that those are job killers and we don't need that. And so they're, at this point in time, not going anywhere either.
So you wonder, as you get a sense of the of the stresses on these women who are trying to support families on very little money. You just wonder what strategies are out there that someone could grab onto to help a low-income woman get onto a track that to take her up instead of being stuck or losing ground.
Well, it's typically a matter of education. You know, if you're stuck in an occupation that has no room for advancement, as a lot of those lower-wage jobs do, then really the only realistic way out is to be qualified for something that has more upward mobility potential in it. There's no magic answer to how that gets done. I mean, it's a matter of education, maybe going beyond high school education, improving your skill level with employable skills that are going to allow you to rise out of poverty.
Which goes right back to a theme that's been explored so often in this state and certainly on this program about the need for training for those employable skills, because employers are saying, hey, we do need people to fill a lot of different jobs. We are having a hard time finding enough workers to fill the jobs that we have.
Yeah, with the weight of responsibility that women have within families, you would think whatever remedy one might want to contemplate, we should realize that just the tremendous impact that the prosperity or lack thereof of a female worker has great implications for our society and for our children.
Ted Roloff is a contributing writer for Bridge Magazine. His latest piece is titled, In Paychecks, Michigan Women Have a Long Way to Go, Baby. You'll find it at bridgemi.com. Ted Roloff, good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Ava Obrecht, Jake Offenhart, Shana Roth, and Katrina Schaefer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.